Boris Farivar, author of the book Hobbyist Data, will speak on legal and privacy history and what our rights are currently, and how law enforcement agencies and companies can collect and use our private details, often without our knowledge. Again, that's Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech with Cyrus Farivar on Monday, November 18th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Northwest Academy, 1130 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, former ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch testifies in the impeachment investigation.
Governor Brown's ban on flavored cannabis vaping products is struck down.
And county officials move to triple the price of car tags to fund renovations to the Burnside Bridge.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 15th, 2019. I'm Claire Rosciato.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. In the ongoing impeachment inquiry into President Trump and his dealings with Ukraine, today former Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch testified in front of the House Intelligence Committee. Yovanovitch is a longtime career diplomat, serving in the Forest Service for 33 years before she was abruptly terminated from her post this last May. That was before some of the key dates Democrats are looking at in this inquiry, but Yovanovitch's testimony made clear that she felt a smear campaign had been waged against her by the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. She credited the smear campaign for her dismissal. Perhaps most notable was the tweet from the president during Yovanovitch's live testimony. Trump claimed, quote, "Everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went, turned bad," end quote. House Intelligence Committee Adam Schiff labeled the president's comment as a form of witness intimidation. The president's comments were condemned by both Democrats and Republicans, though Republicans stayed strong in their defense of the president overall. In their questioning, Republicans attacked Representative Schiff instead of attacking the former ambassador, perhaps with the idea that it would come off poorly.
Governor Kate Brown's recent ban on flavored cannabis vaping products may be up in smoke. The Oregon Court of Appeals issued a decision Thursday striking down last month's stay of the ban, claiming businesses that have faltered as a result of the ruling are unjustly to blame. Both nicotine and cannabis-flavored vaping products were part of the ban. Two Oregon deaths and thousands of lung-related illnesses have been documented across the country, with flavored vaping products cited as the main issue. Further research has observed that terpenes, previously suspected to have been the culprit in the illnesses, are not derived from marijuana at all. Officials in support of the blockage point at the additive vitamin E acetate as a more likely source of the illnesses, noting flavorings of both nicotine and marijuana products have been in use for years. Jesse Buntecue, with the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Associate, told OPB, quote, "We're encouraged the court agreed with our position and thinks there is a need for deeper dive into the scientific aspects behind the ban," end quote. Vaping industry advocates also argue public health could face greater risk by eliminating safer alternatives to smoking cigarettes and pushing consumer usage into the black market.
Multnomah County commissioners unanimously endorsed a plan to raise vehicle registration fees to partially fund renovation of the Burnside Bridge. The plan would raise county registration fees to $56 in January if it is approved during the final vote on December 5th. The Burnside Bridge has been targeted for seismic retrofitting, meaning that in the event of an earthquake, the bridge would still be standing and safe to cross. Portland and the Pacific Northwest sit on the Cascadia subduction zone, which has the capacity to unleash a massive earthquake in the region during our lifetimes. Bridges in and around the downtown core were built before our understanding of the threat of earthquakes in the region. In the event of a major earthquake, the connection between the east and west sides of the river could be lost for weeks or even months, making it very difficult to supply needed aid. The county has raised vehicle tags before in 2009 when it used the increase to fund the renovation of the Sellwood Bridge, which is notably the only bridge in Portland with a chance to survive the big one. Retrofitting the Burnside Bridge is expected to cost $850 million, and the tag increase would only fund $550 million of that. While the cost increase may be unpleasant, the Burnside Bridge could serve as a regional lifeline, which Commissioner Lori Stegman called, quote, a small price to pay, end quote, to protect lives across the region.
Technology could be making fraud easier to commit, and a national anti-fraud expert for AARP brought some tips for fraud prevention to Oregon this week. KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
Immortalized in the film Catch Me If You Can, Frank Abagnale has long since left his days of scamming behind, and now offers advice on how to avoid fraud. Over the past 43 years, Abagnale has advised the FBI as an expert on forgery, embezzlement, and secure documents. Last night, he joined forces with the AARP Fraud Watch Network to speak in Portland. Abagnale says the distance that modern technology creates between scammer and victim makes it even easier to commit fraud than it used to be.
Today you're dealing with somebody in their pajamas with a cup of coffee on a laptop in their kitchen in Moscow. They're thousands of miles away in India, Moscow, China. They don't know you. They'll never see you. The victim never makes any emotional contact with them. So there really is no compassion, and they'll steal everything you have.
Abagnale notes millennials are actually more likely to be scammed, but older generations lose more money because they tend to have more. He says education about how to protect yourself against fraud is the best tool to fight it. With the holiday season coming up, Abagnale says charity scams are ramping up, and folks should check with the Better Business Bureau if an organization they don't know calls and solicits money. Another popular hoax is the grandparent scam, when a caller poses as a local police officer and says you need to post bail for a grandchild. If you've been scammed, Abagnale notes it's important to let someone know.
You need to report these things, not feel embarrassed that someone took you, because anybody can be scammed, including myself. But if you are scammed, you need to tell somebody so that something can be done about it, or they'll go on and scam somebody else.
He says that means reporting the scam to their state attorney general's office or contact AARP if they would like to know what their next step should be. For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Althea Billings.
Low water levels in several reservoirs in the Willamette Valley have caused Army Corps of Engineers officials to issue a warning of potential hazards to users. The Willamette Valley has 13 Corps-operated dams and reservoirs that work together to manage flood risk, provide water supply, and recreation areas to the region. The low levels are a result of the scant rain this fall. The lack of rain has exposed the soft, muddy areas of lakebed, which can be dangerous to users. The areas will be closed when necessary to address safety concerns. For example, Cottage Grove's lakeside boat ramp will have limited access through the weekend and will close on Monday until water levels rise back to normal. Other potentially hazardous lake beds include Fall Creek and Cougar Reservoirs. The Corps of Engineers cautions reservoir users to avoid these areas for their own safety.
A Beaverton veterinarian with a previously revoked license was arrested Thursday on charges of aggravated animal abuse. Dr. Daniel Godkohler was indicted November 8th on two counts of first-degree aggravated animal abuse and two first-degree counts of first-degree animal abuse. Beaverton police responded to reports of abuse at the Companion Pet Clinic on Southwest Allen Boulevard on September 20th. The allegations were further investigated by the Oregon Humane Society. Coller first got his license to practice as a veterinarian in Oregon and California in 1974. An ensuing history of animal abuse and allegations led to the Oregon Vet Board revoking his license in 2010. Among the multiple violations on Coller's record include the brutalization of a dog in 1977, allowing an unlicensed student to perform a hysterectomy on a cat in 1978, unauthorized euthanizing of animals, and injecting himself with animal anesthetics, as well as losing patients' records. In 2004, Portland attorney Susan Ford filed a 79-page complaint with the veterinary board on behalf of Kohler's former front office manager, Marina Shaming, and an unnamed animal welfare advocate.
Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is officially running for president, saying he can attract more independents and moderate Republicans than any other candidate. Lily Bulkley has more of the story with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa. As Senate Republicans in Washington were blocking a vote on universal background checks for gun purchases yesterday, news of a high school shooting unfolded in Santa Clarita, California. National headlines and impeachment proceedings are changing the political calculus daily. Six of the current presidential contenders, all Democrats, may be sitting in a lengthy Senate trial of President Donald Trump, leaving more space on the campaign trail for others like former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who filed for the New Hampshire primary yesterday.
This time is about the character of the country. This time is about whether the day after the election, America will keep her promises. This time is about more than removing an unpopular and divisive leader, as important as that is, but about delivering instead for you.
His announcement comes 354 days before the general election, less time than any successful nominee has had upon entering the race. Patrick is positioning himself as someone who can attract more moderate independents and Republicans, who may be turned off by the boldness of people like Senators Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. But Patrick's not the first Democratic candidate to prioritize unity. It's a common goal for many of the cycle's candidates, such as New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and former Vice President Joe Biden. Iowa State Representative Ross Wilburn supports California Senator Kamala Harris, in part because he sees her as a unifier.
I like the fact that she keeps our attention on us coming together as Democrats and inviting independents and more moderate Republicans together to recapture the White House.
On the other hand, some voters care less about party unity and more about candidates sticking to their values. Audrey Wheeler, freshman at Iowa State University, supports Bernie Sanders.
I don't want a president who is moderate, who's going to, you know, change their ideas based on what everyone else is saying. I want someone who's going to stick up for, like, what they believe in all the time.
From a Republican point of view, Story County GOP party chair Brett Barker says he's observed a shift leftward among Democratic candidates, though he sees this as part of the process in a competitive primary.
Just like with anything, I think both parties have to secure their base, and then they kind of move from there into grabbing votes in the middle.
President Trump, though, hasn't put much effort into garnering favor in the middle, according to Drake University professor Dennis Goldford.
He believes that base plus the additional Republicans who support him for policy reasons, they got him elected the first time, so he's relying on them to get elected a second time. And unlike other presidents in the past of both parties, he's not made any real attempt to expand that constituency.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, where host Janine Jackson will be discussing the recent coup in Bolivia with Alex Main, the Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, The Struggle. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will have early fog and considerable clouds. The high will be 56 degrees. Today in history, in 1920, the first assembly of the League of Nations is held in Geneva, Switzerland. The League was notable for being the first worldwide intergovernmental organization whose principal mission was to maintain world peace. The League of Nations eventually failed, but its failure set out the blueprint for the United Nations. The quote of the day is from Ghanaian diplomat and former Secretary General of the United States, Kofi Annan, who said of the United Nations, quote, "More than ever before in human history, we share a common destiny. We can master it only if we face it together. And that, my friends, is why we have the United Nations."
Recent government data shows nearly 70,000 migrant children have been detained in the United States in 2019 alone. 69,550 children have been held in government custody away from their families, far outnumbering statistics reported from any other country, according to the United Nations researchers. This number also shows a 42% increase from 2019. These numbers reflect President Trump's hardline immigration policy. These policies have increased the period of time children will spend in custody, despite the government's acknowledgement it does them harm by putting them at increased risk of physical and emotional trauma. Tens of thousands of detainees have been deported. Others have been reunited with their parents and families residing in the United States. Approximately 4,000 remain in government custody at any given time, with many children and teens arriving weekly. Often separated from their parents, many arrive at the border alone. Detention centers for the displaced youth are often, quote, overcrowded and squalid, end quote, as reported by the Associated Press. Federal law requires the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Refugee Resettlement, to provide adequate shelter, food, and medical aid to children in detention. Conversely, recent statistics in other countries with children held in governmental custody shows vastly lower numbers. 2,000 children were reported in Australia in 2013. Canada had 155 held in temporary federal custody in 2018. And in the UK, 42 migrant children were held in shelters for 2017.
Red tide is back and getting worse in the Tampa Bay area. Carinia brevis, an organism more commonly known as red tide, was detected in high levels in water samples collected by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission in Sarasota County late last week. Five fish die-offs were reported this week in Venice and Englewood. FWC officials say the organism is natural to the Gulf of Mexico, but it can multiply uncontrollably and travel inshore via currents and wind. The massive blooms of algae can lead to respiratory irritation in humans and pets and cause marine life deaths, particularly of shellfish. Some scientific research supports the idea that runoff from various fertilizers may contribute to the rapid growth of the algae blooms. Runoffs contribute elevated amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus, a nutrient to the organism, into aquatic ecosystems. From 2017 to 2018, saw red tide hit southwestern Florida in deadly concentrations for over 14 months. Hundreds of tons of dead fish were collected from beaches, as hundreds of sea turtles and manatee casualties were reported. County's hardest hit reported losses of over $100 million, as well as hundreds of workers laid off.
Uber has been fined $640 million in New Jersey for classifying its workers incorrectly as independent contractors rather than employees. The sum comes from back taxes owed by the company for the misclassification. Advocates say the job classification hurts both workers and the states they live in, which end up missing out on tax revenues. New Jersey is one of the strictest states when it comes to determining whether a worker can be classified as an independent contractor. The services performed must fall outside the employer's usual course of business, which would not include drivers for ride-sharing companies like Uber. Robert Asaro Angelo, the New Jersey Labor Commissioner, says worker classifications are important because taxpayers pay the price for unemployment or disability insurance when independent contractors file for benefits. He said, quote, "This defiance of the law puts honest business owners at an unfair disadvantage," end quote. The decision is the latest setback for Uber and other gig economy companies that rely heavily on contract labor. Another decision came in September in California when the state passed a law requiring Uber and Lyft to classify their drivers as employees, guaranteeing them benefits, a minimum wage, and a right to unionize.
Two prominent scientific groups have dropped job postings from their websites for Brigham Young University due to the school's LGBTQ policies. With more on the story, we have KBOO's own Jeffrey Wade. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thanks. So as reported Monday, the Washington-based American Geophysical Union and the Colorado-based Geological Society of America took down the job ads over BYU's honor code ban on homosexual expression and behavior. The private school in Provo, Utah, owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, proclaims to be an equal opportunity employer, but also maintains all faculty and students abide by its dress, grooming, and honor codes. Both the scientific groups are nonprofit earth and space science groups. When the job ads were pulled, they called out BYU for being anti-LGBTQ. Supporters of both groups maintain the wording in the honor code is discriminatory and inconsistent with their ethical standards. As a private school and religious institution, the school can legally maintain the honor code. Other national groups have garnered controversy for collaborating with BYU, including the Society for Political Methodology in 2018 for holding its annual conference at the school, acknowledging many LGBTQ participants declined to take part.
In Montana, the State Tribal Relations Committee has adopted a motion on the Keystone XL pipeline asking the Montana Congressional Delegation to put pressure on the State Department. The State Department is in charge of the 45-day public comment period on the proposed pipeline, which is scheduled to end on this coming Monday. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The State Tribal Relations Committee is pressuring Montana's congressional delegation to do more to increase public input and tribal consultation on the Keystone XL pipeline. As Olivia Reingold reports, the move comes as the end of the public comment period for a recently updated environmental statement nears.
The State Tribal Relations Committee unanimously adopted a motion Monday to write a letter demanding a more meaningful public comments process on the updated Keystone XL pipeline's draft environmental impact statement. The letter asks Montana's congressional delegation to put pressure on the State Department, which controls the 45-day public comment period that is scheduled to end next Monday, the 18th. There's been one public meeting to discuss the draft, held late last month in Billings. That's not good enough, according to the letter by the State Tribal Relations Committee, a bipartisan body of legislators that acts as liaisons between the state and tribal governments. It says people who attended didn't have enough of a chance to openly engage in dialogue and provide input. It also says tribal consultation has fallen short for the Fort Belknap and Fort Peck tribes, which the pipeline would nearly come in contact with. Republican Congressman Greg Gianforte and Republican Senator Steve Dane say they look forward to speaking with committee members. A spokesperson for the Democratic Senator John Tester says the State Department should solicit further feedback from tribal leaders and the public. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold in Billings, Montana.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez has decided the tribe will not financially back bonds necessary for the purchase of three coal mines by a Navajo-owned company. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports tribal leaders worry the investment could negatively impact the tribe's finances.
President Nez says the Navajo Transitional Energy Company hasn't given leaders key financial information about the mines. He also says the tribe should be moving more toward renewables, and energy experts question the wisdom of the Navajo Nation expanding its interests in coal as the industry struggles. As a result, Nez canceled agreements NTEC might have relied on to seek the tribe's financial support. NTEC is owned by the Navajo Nation, but operates independently of the tribal government. The company announced in August that it bought three mines in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana at an auction of the bankrupt Cloud Peak Energy. Among them is the third largest coal mine in the nation, and they collectively employ more than 1,000 workers. In a statement, an NTEC spokesperson says it respects the president's decision and that the company remains profitable while it explores future options. NTEC says the purchase of the three mines makes the Navajo Nation the third largest coal producer in the country. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
This week, the Minnesota Supreme Court heard arguments over the name change of a popular Minneapolis lake. The Associated Press reports the court is considering whether the state's Natural Resources Department had authority to change Lake Calhoun to its Dakota name, Bede-Makoska. A lower court ruled the agency overstepped its authority and it should be handled by the legislature. Members of the Native community are in support of the name change, while the group Save Lake Calhoun is fighting it. Signs already reflect the lake's Dakota name. A decision by the court is likely to take months. Meanwhile, public input has been gathered for the renaming for part of the Minnesota landmark Fort Snelling, which resides on Dakota homeland. The Minnesota Historical Society has received more than 6,000 comments for the renaming of 23 acres known as Historic Fort Snelling. The name of the 1820s fort structure will remain Fort Snelling. The site is being revitalized and is slated to be finished next year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Trump ally and longtime Republican operative Roger Stone has been convicted today of witness tampering and lying to Congress. Stone was arrested in January and charged with misleading the House Intelligence Committee in 2017 about his efforts to find out when WikiLeaks would be releasing emails hacked from the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. Ex-White House chief strategist Steve Bannon and one-time Trump campaign aide Rick Gates testified against Stone under a plea deal struck with former special counsel Robert Mueller. Stone is the sixth Trump aide or advisor to be convicted of charges brought as part of Mueller's probe. He was also convicted of witness tampering for attempting to intimidate Randy Credeco, a radio talk show host who acted as an intermediary between Stone and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Stone's sentencing date is set for February 6, and he faces up to 20 years in prison for his crimes.
Colombia's carbon tax could help protect the Amazon. It also aims to reduce the country's reliance on fossil fuels. Dr. Anthony Lisowitz has more of the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The vast tropical forests of Colombia contain an immense amount of carbon, but they are being cut down at a rapid rate. So protecting and restoring these forests is an important way to slow global warming. In 2017, the country implemented a plan to encourage forest protection while also reducing carbon pollution. It starts with a carbon tax on liquid fossil fuels.
It will incentivize companies to use less fossil fuels because now they have to pay tax on them. It's more expensive.
That's Sebastian Treng, executive vice president at the nonprofit Conservation International. He says some of the tax revenue funds projects that protect forests. What's more, companies get a tax break if they take the initiative to reduce carbon pollution. Many have therefore invested in reforestation projects. Colombia generates less than 1% of the world's carbon pollution. But Treng says its carbon tax model
highlights the potential that other larger economies have to put similar systems in place that would be tremendously beneficial, both in terms of driving down emissions from industry and in terms of supporting conservation and restoration efforts for our remaining forests.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 15th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Kevin Dugan. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Claire Rosciato.
Thank you.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale.
This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio.
Bring them to KBOO Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. till 7 p.m.
We are accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Saturday, December 14th. The sale will be held on December 21st. Stay tuned for details.
Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasure to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for our community radio station, KBOO.
If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email volunteer@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 213.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Hot Sardines, bringing their jazz to the Newmark Theater on Sunday, November 24th. Tickets are available at portland5.com.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Washington Post doesn't want you to be confused, so they headlined their editorial, "Bolivia is in danger of slipping into anarchy. It's Evo Morales' fault." Elite U.S. media, you understand, are deeply invested in the well-being of Bolivia's people, who are in an uproar after a coup ousting Morales over charges of irregularities in the recent election that appear to have no evidential grounding or, in U.S. media's view, to require any. Back in 2006, U.S. media were counseling Morales that policies like nationalizing the country's gas industry were popular but not the answer to Bolivia's